This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program. We won't be taking your phone calls today, but stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Mueller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Mueller.
Hello, America. Welcome to the Albert Mueller Program. Should churches and Christian institutions be able to discriminate for employment on the basis of sexual orientation? Let's put it this way. Should your church be required to hire someone, say, who's had a sex change operation because a non-discrimination law in the state or in the area would say that your church must? If not your church, what about the local Christian ministry? What about the local Christian college? These are not hypothetical questions anymore. We're going to be turning to that question in just a few moments. We have a special guest from the Christian Legal Society, and we're going to be talking about why we had better be paying attention to this question now, and we'd better be framing this issue as what it is, a very central and non-negotiable religious liberty issue. The phone number to join the conversation is 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. First, to review some issues in the news at my website, albertmueller.com. Overnight, I posted an article entitled Jihad and the Weakness of the West. And I wrote about this because Professor Emeritus Bernard Lewis at Princeton University has written a really very important article in the Wall Street Journal in which he explains that the Islamic jihadists in the West read history very differently. Now, you know, when you hear that, I would immediately think of something like the Crusades. Go back to the medieval centuries and realize that you have the West and the Muslims reading history very differently in terms of rise and fall, in terms of the Crusades, in terms of who did what to whom and why it matters. But Bernard Lewis is not looking back to the medieval era. He's looking back to the late 1980s. He's looking at the fall of the Soviet Union. Listen to this argument. He talks about the fact that the Islamic jihadists have adopted a two-stage strategy to attack what they saw as the two great enemies of the Muslim dream of having the entire world under Sharia law. What are they looking at? They were looking at the two threats of the Soviet Union and the West. Listen to what he says. For a long time, the main enemy was seen with some plausibility as being the West, and some Muslims were, naturally enough, willing to accept what help they could get against that enemy. This explains the widespread support in Arab countries and in some other places, first for the Third Reich and after its collapse for the Soviet Union. These were the main enemies of the West, and therefore natural allies, then, for the Muslims. Now the situation had changed. The more immediate, more dangerous enemy was the Soviet Union, already ruling a number of Muslim countries and daily increasing its influence and presence in others. Let me interrupt the article here in order to say that Bernard Lewis's point is that the two-stage strategy of the Muslim jihadists to take down the Soviet Union and then the West saw the West as the bigger problem, but as the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan and as the Soviet Union exerted its control and sovereignty over the various stands there in Central Asia, they decided that the most pressing issue was to get the Soviet Union out of Muslim lands. Now listen to where this picks up. It was therefore natural to seek and accept American help, that is, as in the fall of Afghanistan and the victory of over the Soviet Union there. As Osama bin Laden explained, in this final phase of the millennial struggle, the world of the unbelievers was divided between two superpowers. The first task was to deal with the more deadly and more dangerous of the two, the Soviet Union. After that, dealing with the pampered and degenerate Americans would be easy. We in the Western world see the defeat and collapse of the Soviet Union as a Western, more specifically, an American victory in the Cold War. For Osama bin Laden and his followers, it was a Muslim victory in a jihad, and given the circumstances, this perception does not lack plausibility, end quote. Now, what Professor Lewis means about plausibility there is not that we would think that's a plausible argument, but rather that in Arab eyes, in what is now called the Arab street, that would be a plausible argument. In other words, there are millions of Muslims, especially young Muslims, in the streets of Muslim nations who think that they successfully brought down the Soviet Union. This feeds, Professor Lewis says, their perception that it will be even easier to bring down the degenerate and very pampered West. Now, I think Bernard Lewis's argument is very, very important. Not only is he one of the most influential observers of the Middle East, is one of the most respected voices in terms of international affairs, but I think his article is extremely timely. The jihadists see the West as a far weaker enemy than the Soviets. They see the radicals in the West as basically serving their cause. They also see the West as poised for collapse. Back to Professor Lewis's article, he says, stage one of the jihad was to drive the infidels from the lands of Islam, stage two to bring the war into the enemy camp, and the attacks of 9/11 were clearly intended to be the opening salvo of this stage. The response to 9/11, so completely out of accord with previous American practice, came as a shock, and it is noteworthy that there has been no successful attack on American soil since then. Now, we could debate the issues related to Afghanistan and Iraq and the war on terror ad infinitum. But Bernard Lewis here makes a fascinating point, and that is that he would argue that Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and the Muslim jihadists were surprised that America hit back so hard after the attacks of 9/11, and he suggests that has taught them a lesson. But he also suggests that they're listening now. More recent developments, he writes, and notably the public discourse inside the United States, are persuading increasing numbers of Islamist radicals that their first assessment was correct after all, and that they need only to press a little harder to achieve final victory. It is not yet clear whether they are right or wrong in this view. If they are right, the consequences, both for Islam and for America, will be deep, wide, and lasting, end quote. I think it's worth giving this much attention to Bernard Lewis's article because I think his argument holds water. I think it's very important for us to do exactly what he does here, and that is look at the perceptions of those who see the West as the civilization they would wish to destroy and supplant. Look at their presuppositions. Look at the way they look at the world. Look at the way they read history. And then Professor Lewis invites us to imagine how they hear the conversation now going on in the West, the kind of conversation that now goes on in our media, the kind of conversation that now goes on in our government. And he suggests that this is fueling their perception that they were right after all. The West, America in particular, is weak and without resolve and basically poised for collapse. When we're talking about collapse, the collapse of a shared worldview leads to some of the most amazing realities. And when the intersection of high technology, especially biotech and reproductive technology, all comes together, you end up with amazing reports such as the news out of Maryland today. Maryland's high court has decided that a baby conceived from an egg donated by one woman and implanted in another woman may have no mother at all. Now, the only sensical part of this entire decision is when the court says that the technology has outpaced the law. But what sense does it make for a child to have no mother? The legalities here are what's important. I mean, after all, this issue is being defined because one woman says, I want the responsibility of being the mother, and the other says, I don't want to have the responsibility in any sense of continuing obligation for being the mother. The surrogate wants legal protection from having any continuing relationship or obligation to the baby, and the court's decision is maybe it doesn't have a mother. You know, I just have to go back to one of my favorite books when I was a little boy. My parents read it to me, and it was the book Are You My Mother by Dr. Seuss. And there must be millions of American kids that remember this book about the little chick, the little bird asking the question of everything from a dog to a bulldozer, are you my mother? And then you'll remember the mother comes back with a worm, and all of a sudden he realizes, this is my mother. Well, what are you going to tell this baby when he says, who is my mother? Are you my mother? Maryland's High Court says maybe this child doesn't have a mother. Reading here from the report from the Baltimore Sun, the man who arranged for the children to be born from his sperm and donated eggs and the woman with whom he arranged to carry them brought the case, the two wanted it made clear that she, that is the surrogate, had no legal claims or responsibility for the children. Chief Justice Robert M. Bell, writing for the majority, wrote, what had not been fathomed exists today. The methods by which people can produce children have changed. One final quirk in this, the ruling is complicated because of Maryland's Equal Rights Amendment. The court found that paternity laws apply equally to men and women. Now, that's where, again, you just have to look at the language to know what kind of trouble we're in. The word there is paternity. Let's just remind ourselves of what we know here. That refers to the father. Paternity is the opposite of maternity. This court has, in one decision, decided that there are now some children that may not have a mother, that's maternity. But they've also decided that the Equal Rights Amendment in Maryland requires that paternity laws apply equally to men and women. Well, good luck with that, justices. I'd like to see exactly how you're going to apply that. The reality is that it's not only the reproductive technologies that have so outpaced the development of the law, it's that common sense has been left behind because this goal of having a completely egalitarian society ignores the obvious. There is a difference between paternity and maternity. Everybody knows it. A court's decision isn't going to change that fact. We'll be back to talk about whether your church or the local Christian college should be required to hire on the basis of non-discrimination laws about sexual orientation and all the rest. It's going to be a fascinating discussion, and I'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. The entire realm of the law, given over now to non-discrimination law, is an area that is fast expanding, and it's getting more and more complicated. But the big questions still seem to remain. Let's assume that there is a law that grants an exemption to churches. A law, let's say, that prohibits discrimination on the basis of gender or sexual orientation or et cetera. And a church is looking at hiring, but let's say it's not hiring the pastor of the church or the youth pastor. Let's say it's hiring an administrator of a child care program. Or let's shift it from the church to the local Christian college. Can these colleges that are established as Christian institutions, accountable to Christian churches, be held by the law to a non-discrimination challenge? Can they be forced to hire persons whose lifestyles are at variance with the very convictions that they hold most closely as based in Scripture? Greg Baylor is director of the Christian Legal Society Center for Law and Religious Freedom. He is a graduate of Dartmouth College and received his law degree from the Duke University School of Law. He is also a man who's been watching these events and these developments with great interest. Greg Baylor, welcome to the Albert Mohler Program.
Good. It's great to be with you. Thank you.
Greg, I saw an article you wrote a few days ago that really caught my attention, in which you talk about the exemption narrowing. And perhaps you should give us a background to this. Your article is entitled, "Honey, I Shrunk the Exemption." That got my attention. Why would you write that, and what's going on?
Well, the exemption that we're talking about is one in a bill that's been introduced in Congress. It was introduced by Representative Barney Frank of Massachusetts, who's one of the few openly gay members of Congress. This bill is called the Employment Non-Discrimination Act. What it does is that it adds sexual orientation to the list of protected characteristics in the federal employment anti-discrimination law. Now, the Title VII of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 has been around for a long time, and everyone in the country pretty much is comfortable with its ban on race discrimination, gender discrimination, national origin discrimination, and the like. What gay rights advocates have been doing for the last 10 years or so has been trying to add sexual orientation to that list of protected characteristics. And every version of the bill that's been introduced in the past had a very broad and almost categorical exemption for religious organizations, churches, Christian colleges, Christian schools, faith-based social service providers. All of them would continue to be allowed to take sexual conduct into account in their personnel decisions. And what happened with the most recent version of the bill that was introduced just last month by Representative Frank is you have an exemption that's narrower, a religious exemption that's narrower. Now, exactly how much narrower remains to be seen, but I saw this as a troubling development because I have never believed that folks on the other side of this issue, the homosexual rights advocates, have any sort of principled commitment to religious freedom, to religious associational freedom. They just want to do what they can get away with. And that's why this narrower exemption, "Honey, I Shrunk It," is disturbing to me.
I want to read to you some language that you cited in your article. And this, I assume, is from House Bill 2015.
Yes.
The bill that is put forth by Representative Barney Franks, it says that the ban on sexual orientation discrimination, quote, shall not apply with respect to the employment of individuals whose primary duties consist of teaching or spreading religious doctrine or belief, religious governance, supervision of a religious order, supervision of persons teaching or spreading religious doctrine or belief, or supervision or participation in religious ritual or worship, end quote. Now, assuming that that's the language, Mr. Baylor, I want to ask you a question because I serve as president of a seminary in a Christian college. What if I have someone teaching sociology? Does that person fall under this exemption?
Well, it certainly does not to me, as I understand how Christian colleges operate, and I have some familiarity with them. And I think if you asked a sociology professor or a chemistry professor at Wheaton College or something like that whether you, quote, teach doctrine or engage in ritual, they would say no. Now, they wouldn't say that what I do is entirely separated from the religious mission of the institution. It's integral to it. But I don't think that someone who teaches that sort of subject falls within the scope of that part of the exemption, and that's why it's troubling.
Yeah, I think it's extremely troubling, and it's troubling for someone who is president of a Christian college and a seminary, but I think it also should be very much a matter of direct concern to pastors of churches, because when I look at this, I just wonder how many, say, staff positions or ministry positions in churches might not be covered by the precise language of this exemption.
Yeah, and you know, the other problem, too, is you have a bunch of words there that are subject to interpretation. It's, you know, our discussion here evinces the fact that it's not self-evident what those mean. And what do you want? Do you want to have everyone subject to litigation for sort of guessing wrong about how a court will interpret those words? That's a disturbing problem as well. I mean, before, when the previous versions of the bill were introduced, there was a categorical ban on a categorical exemption for religious employers. That's pretty simple. You know that if you're a Christian school or a church or a seminary or a Christian college, you don't have to worry about this. Now, with all these words in there, you do have to worry about it.
Folks, to join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. You may have a very pointed question. You may have a general question related to this big issue. Mr. Greg Baylor, who is with the Christian Legal Society, and as the director of their Center for Law and Religious Freedom, is my guest. You can feel free to ask him a question, raise the issue. The phone number 877-893-TALK. Mr. Baylor, I want to come back to you for a moment because when you look at this big issue, let me tell you, there's a background, obviously, to this, even among conservative Christians who say, you know, that the political sphere obviously is not our main concern, and I want to affirm that wholeheartedly, that there is no cultural mandate on par with the evangelism mandate, the Great Commission mandate. I believe that with all my heart. But I do believe we have a political responsibility, and I do believe that being a citizen in a representative democracy means you have to take some responsibility, because just even reading Romans 13 is kind of like we in part become Caesar here. We've got to decide what kind of government we're going to have.
Right.
But I think this issue, when it gets right down to the religious liberty level, puts it right on in front of where many people may not have seen the issue before. So I want to throw out a couple of tangible examples, and you tell me if I'm off base, all right?
Okay, sure.
Let's say that you're a church and you have a daycare center or a child care center, or you have nursery workers that you have in the course of even your church schedule. And the law comes along and says you cannot discriminate against a homosexual or someone who's been through a sex change operation or transvestite, transgendered, or whatever, on that basis. It doesn't look to me like this exemption makes that exempt.
Well, it does depend. Now, first of all, it's important to point out that this isn't the law yet, and there is no federal law that bans sexual orientation discrimination. This is what might be coming. The second thing to point out is, despite that fact, there are 17 states in the District of Columbia that do ban sexual orientation discrimination in employment. What makes that even more complicated is the fact that many of those statutes have exemptions for religious employers. Now, some of them have categorical exemptions that say, look, if you're a religious employer, you don't have to worry about this. Some of them are more like the one that we read in this bill that was introduced by Representative Frank this year, and sort of try to draw some line between some jobs and other jobs. Obviously, maybe the pastor, you can care about that sort of thing, but maybe not the administrator in the daycare center. Now, the next question is, suppose that the law does tell this employer that they can't consider someone's extramarital sexual conduct, including homosexual conduct. What can the employer say in response to that? Can they say, hey, time out, the Constitution of the United States forbids you, the government, from applying that rule to me? And that is, unfortunately, an unsettled question. I think there are some great cases that have been decided by the Supreme Court and the lower courts that suggest pretty clearly that the religious employer ought to be exempt from this law, that the government cannot punish them for making faith-based personnel decisions. Now, there are folks on the other side of this issue who are arguing very hard for the opposite position, and it's not well settled in the law. That's one of the things we're trying to do at our organization, is to get that law well settled so that future generations don't have to worry about this problem.
Well, I appreciate your goal to get it well settled, so long as well settled means it's settled in a way that protects our religious liberty. I know that is what you mean.
Indeed it is.
We'll be right back to continue this conversation. The issue is whether our churches and Christian institutions should be free to discriminate, that is, to hire on the basis of our own biblical convictions. We'll be right back.
Stay tuned for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter. Dr. Moeller is president of the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary and one of the nation's leading theologians and cultural commentators. Now, here's your host, Dr. Albert Moeller.
Well, welcome to the Brave New World. On this program, we have to look at issues ranging from changes in reproductive technology, beginning of life, end of life issues, to the world picture, to, of course, what goes on in terms of religious liberty and public policy in this country. My guest today is Gregory S. Baylor, director of the Christian Legal Society Center for Law and Religious Freedom. Mr. Baylor is on this program today because of work he has been doing in the field of religious liberty and the kind of non-discrimination legislation that is now before Congress, especially a bill known as House Resolution 2015, put forward by Massachusetts Representative Barney Frank. The big issue here is the narrowing of the exemption language for Christian or for religious institutions. Now, when we went into the break, I was asking Mr. Baylor about some hypotheticals, but I want to go to an actual. And, Mr. Baylor, I really appreciate you kind of serving as counsel to us for a few moments here.
No problem.
But this is a case that came to my attention about 2 years ago. You have a Christian school. You have a third-grade class. In the third-grade class, you have a teacher. The teacher was Mrs. Smith on the weekend and is Mr. Smith on Monday morning. The school fires the person because of conduct unbecoming a Christian institution, and the employee sues. Mm-hmm. It looks to me like that Christian school would be in big trouble if this law passes.
Well, they might be. I mean, this law increases the possibility that they're going to get sued. Now, they may still win because you do have this exemption in here, and it does have three parts to it. And there's a part that we haven't talked about yet that's somewhat vague that talks about if the employer is willing to declare that it has this policy of taking sexual conduct into account, they might be able to get off the hook. There's a lot of ambiguous and vague words in that part of the exemption, so I think they would still have an argument that they're exempt. But again, it would be much, much better if this version of the bill did what all the other versions of the bill did in the past, which was to categorically exempt religious employers. The other problem with this statute is if you're not a religious employer, say you're a Christian person who runs a for-profit business, well, you don't even have any argument that you're exempt at all because you're probably not going to be deemed by the court to be a religious employer because you're a for-profit business. So, man, this exemption doesn't even touch that problem.
Well, and we're looking at that being more and more settled law in terms of even municipal and state and county non-discrimination laws across the country.
Right. That's the thing. There are, like I said before, there are 17 states in the District of Columbia banned sexual orientation discrimination in employment. And, you know, to be clear and to be fair, most of them have reasonably broad religious exemptions. But there are hundreds of municipalities and counties that have ordinances that prohibit this sort of discrimination. And their exemptions sometimes aren't that good. We saw a Christian college in Florida get sued under one of these. We saw a Christian college in Chicago get sued under one of these. Another college in Michigan was recently threatened with litigation over one of these. So I think this is sort of a wave of the future.
Now, let me just ask you another quick question. Is there any distinction here between, say, orientation and behavior? So let's take homosexuality off the table here for a moment. Let's say that you've got a band director in a Christian school or a music professor in a Christian college, and you discover that this person's been having an extramarital affair.
Right.
And the college or school code of honor says that such things, such sexual immorality, is incompatible with employment in the school.
Right.
Does this law give that person a ground to sue?
Well, it may or it may not. I've always had trouble with the definition of sexual orientation in these bills. The definition that's in H.R. 2015, the Barney Frank bill that we're talking about, doesn't really shed a lot of light on what sexual orientation means. It refers not only to homosexuality, but also to heterosexuality and bisexuality as well. But even those three words don't tell you a lot. What do they mean? Do they refer solely to someone's experience of attraction to someone of the same sex or the opposite sex or both sex? Or does it include sort of indulging those inclinations and actually engaging in the behavior? Now, most Christian organizations that I'm familiar with, don't care about the existence of an inclination in and of itself. What they care about is conduct, sexual conduct outside the scope of marriage. But when you start saying stuff that doesn't have a very clear definition, when they simply refer to homosexuality or heterosexuality, it's arguably true that those words not only include inclination, but also include conduct. So it's conceivable that somebody in the situation that you described might be able to invoke this statute. Whether a court would, you know, sort of give credit to their claim, I don't know.
That is simply incredible. We'll be right back to continue this conversation. We've got callers on the line from all across the country. We'll get to those calls in just a moment. To join the conversation, call 877-893-8255. That's 877-893-TALK. At least by now, it should be clearly in focus for all of us that what we're talking about here is religious liberty, whether this country actually believes in it or not. Because if you cannot choose the pastor, the teacher, the employees of your organization as a Christian organization on that basis, then your religious liberty has just been, well, I guess the right word for it is forfeited. We'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mohler Program.
Welcome back to the Albert Mohler Program. This is a fascinating discussion. To join it, call 877-893-8255, 877-893-TALK. My guest is Gregory S. Baylor, Director of the Christian Legal Society Center for Law and Religious Freedom. We're going to go first to caller Sam, calling from Louisville, Kentucky, listening on WFIA. Go ahead, Sam.
Hi. Well, what I would like to say is, consider, for instance, an organization that happened to espouse neo-Nazi views, and they wanted to be exempt from this policy and not hire black people. I don't think that would ever fly, and if, by the same logic, I don't think that any Christian organization should have this exemption and not hire someone because of their religion or because of their or sexual orientation. And the last comment is, since this is all based on Christianity, if we follow the motto of what would Jesus do, who would Jesus exempt? Who would he turn away?
And what would your point be, Sam, out of curiosity? How would you answer your own question?
I don't think he would turn away anyone. And I think...
Have you ever read the Gospels?
Yes.
He does turn people away.
He allows salvation for everyone. And especially in the United States, we should understand that liberty.
Okay, well, number one, you haven't read the Gospels, at least you don't understand them. But let me ask you the question. Are you actually saying here, I want to repeat the words you said. You're saying that a Christian church shouldn't even be able to discriminate on the basis of religion in hiring a pastor?
I think religion may be a stretch. I'll cede that point. But I think something like sexual orientation is a personal, I'm not going to argue whether it's a choice or not, but something that does not need to be an issue within hiring.
Okay, so you don't believe in religious liberty. Well, let me just put it this way. You don't believe in religious liberty. Let's go to Aaron, calling from Peru, Indiana, listening on XM170. Go ahead, Aaron.
Hello, Mr. Mohler. I just wanted to make a quick analogy. I know a lot of women, they struggle with the issue of submission to an unbelieving husband when the husband wants them to do something that they know is sinful. Likewise, we as citizens of a country are called to be under submission of the authorities that were placed underneath. That's as much as they're in accordance to the will of God. If an unbelieving husband wants a believing wife to do something that she knows is sinful, she's not obligated to do that.
I need you to quickly get to the point, Aaron, about this law.
We'd have to resist it. We'd have to disobey it. We'd have to break it.
Okay. I thought that's where you're headed, and I appreciate you making the point. I want to throw it to Greg Baylor and ask him, so what kind of recourse would we have in such a situation?
Well, the problem with a law like this is that it enables somebody who feels like they've been discriminated against to go into court, and the court has the authority to say, hey, you violated this statute, and we're going to impose massive liability on you. And if you disobey the law again, we're going to get you again. So it's not one of these things that you really have a choice about. I mean, really, what do you do? I think the pressure would be enormous to give in to a statute like this, especially one that has an exemption that might even be narrower than this. I mean, one of my points is that the trend is away from broad exemptions. The fact that we have this narrower one today means we may have an even narrower one next time when this bill gets reintroduced if it doesn't pass this time. So it's an enormously difficult problem.
Appreciate that clarification. Let's go to Steve calling, listening on WKMMJ in Grand Island, Nebraska. Go ahead, Steve.
Hi, Dr. Mueller.
Go right ahead.
I have a question. I went to a seminary 20 years ago, and the seminary basically disciplined some students for sexual orientation, homosexuality, but they also disciplined for adultery, sex outside of marriage, that kind of situation. How will this affect that?
Let me turn to Greg Baylor for that answer. Greg, what do you think?
You know, that's an excellent question. Because a lot of times when we get in these controversies, we argue on behalf of our client that our organization does not discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation. First, we don't care about orientation per se. Second, we care about extramarital sexual conduct, whether it's homosexual or heterosexual. I think if that's true with respect to the employer or the organization that's being charged with violating some rule, they have a much better chance of succeeding. But at the end of the day, these rules are about punishing employers and organizations who take homosexual conduct into account. That's what they're aimed at.
Yeah, clearly. I think the aim here is very clear. As I've been reading the text of House Bill 2015, I don't think it could be any more clear. I just wonder what would happen if Americans actually had the opportunity to read this bill. I part of my question, Greg, it would be how is it that that this bill could get so far, even in this Congress?
Well, you know, the folks who support this legislation have been active for many years, and they're very patient, and folks on our side sometimes aren't as patient. The other thing that's going on is I don't want your listeners to be left with the impression that if this bill doesn't pass, we have nothing to worry about. Right now, we have rules that ban sexual orientation discrimination in a variety of contexts that have no exemptions for religious employers. A school in California, California Lutheran High School, has been sued under a California Civil Rights Act that bans sexual orientation discrimination in business establishments because they expelled two students who engaged in lesbian activity. There is no religious exemption in that statute at all. We have all kinds of problems other than this particular bill, and even if it fails, we got trouble.
Okay, now be our lawyer here for a minute. So, Mr. Baylor, what should we do? Should we just trust that somehow this issue is going to work its way through the courts, eventually to the Supreme Court, where there's going to have to be some final decision made here?
Well, I think the Christian church needs to make the public argument about why we do what we do. I think this issue is a perfect opportunity to present the gospel, to say that God has a plan for human sexuality, but he also gives grace to those who don't comply with that plan. Get that message out there. The perception on the other side of this issue is that we're all about hate and we hate homosexuals. This issue gives us an opportunity to say, no, that we do have a righteous God, but we also have a merciful God. The second thing to do is to be involved in the political process and put forward the religious liberty defense. I think a lot of legislators don't know how many religious employers care about the sexual conduct of their employees. They think that this is limited to some sort of subset of, you know, crazy outliers. But really, there are lots and lots and lots of religious employers who care about their employees' religious beliefs and their practices. If we can sort of make that apparent, that this is not just on the margins, this is the center of theologically conservative religion, I think that helps as well. And then third, don't give in. I think there's this idea that if we just, you know, appease a little bit, that the problem will go away. That is not true. If a religious employer organization is confronted with one of these controversies, they need to stand up for their rights.
You know, very fascinating discussion. And, you know, perhaps the most fascinating part of all was the call from Sam, who just was at such pains to point out that he doesn't think there should be any exemption. And, you know, the bottom line of that is it just means a complete denial of religious liberty. But
yeah,
liberty
yeah,
can be
lost. Race with sexual orientation is also just, it just doesn't fly.
It doesn't fly, but that is the agenda, isn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, Bob Jones University lost its tax-exempt status because of its race-based policies. That is the future if we don't do something now.
You know, the amazing thing is you hear nothing against the non-discrimination laws on race from Christian institutions. That's not even a conversation. That shows you how this analogy just falls. We'll be right back.
This is the best of the Albert Mueller Program.
The energy and dynamism of this conversation is an affirmation of the importance of the issue. We're going to have to come back to it again and again because case by case across this country, this is a developing picture. And again, the bottom line is the right of Christian churches and Christian institutions to be Christian. I mean, that's the bottom line. The argument that there should be no exemption means you can't be Christian. You know, if you cannot hold your own ministers and those who would be teachers in Christian institutions, etc., to a Christian code of conduct, then you have been denied religious liberty. It might as well be a regime that just says we're going to take the First Amendment of the Constitution out. And there are obviously some people who would be quite ready to do just that. Time is escaping us. We're going to quickly go to Jason calling from Stanton, Tennessee. Go ahead, Jason.
Hey, Dr. Mueller, here's a question I have. Considering this piece of legislation, isn't this a contradiction to the left's argument about the separation of church and state?
Yeah, what you mean is that they're bringing the state inside the church in this discrimination or anti-discrimination legislation?
Exactly.
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, it's separation of churches and state, except when you want the state to regulate the church. That's the bottom line of that position. And I think you nailed the contradiction neatly, Jason. Thank you for your call. Let's go to Sean listening on XM170 from Shreveport, Louisiana. Go ahead, Sean.
Hey, Dr. Mueller. Sam is promoting that great farce and that trap that's out there to suggest that a man or a woman has no more control over whether or not they're committing adultery or philandering or they're a porn addict or a homosexual. They have no more control over that than their race. That is a farce, and it's a trap, and we should not get sucked into that conversation.
Yeah, and to make that equivalent with race or ethnicity or even physical disability or something like that is obviously a political strategy that that is working. I mean, you're exactly right. It's a false parallel. It is an insinuation of what should be seen as false on its face, and yet let's be honest, they're getting traction with this. Thanks for your call from Shreveport there. Folks, this is a conversation I promise you we will continue. On a case-by-case basis, what we are seeing is that different communities, different churches are becoming aware of what this legislation might mean. One of the most important things that Greg Baylor pointed out in terms of this legislation is that there is not even adequate definition for many of these terms. I mean, legally, what exactly is sexual orientation? And who gets to decide what limitations are put on that list? I mean, if you go to the average American college or university today, and there's not even a gay and lesbian student organization anymore. It's got to be gay and lesbian, transgender, transsexual, bisexual, other, etc. It's going to get to be a longer list. I can promise you that. It's the kind of world we're living in. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about whatever happened to the wedding. It's a very serious question. It looks like Christians are just capitulating to a wedding culture that is mostly about money and spectacle. There's got to be more to it than that. We'll be back tomorrow to talk about it with you.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit our website, www.albertmoeller.com. You'll find archives of past shows and other important resources. You can also email your questions and comments. That's www.albertmoeller.com. Be sure to join us next time for the Albert Mueller Program, your place for intelligent Christian conversation about the issues that matter.